My name is Michael Coates. I'm a former firefighter, but I'm also a former soldier. And it's the stories from the individuals within this military community that I'm desperate to document. Our next guest was born in Afghanistan in the mid-80s. After a traumatic childhood living in conflict, he decided to impact the country in a positive way. He became an interpreter for the British Army for 7 years. He's now seeking safety and opportunity in the UK. Episode 32, Saif Omari. This is Declassified. Just your earliest memory.
Me and my second brother.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had a dog. And I remember we were going back in Tachar and Kunduz. So as a refugee at that time, it was a wartime again. Yeah, so that was my earliest memory, that my grandfather got shot on the leg.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I remember that.
In what way did he get shot? How did he?
I think it was a random shot.
But
it was just random bullets hit his legs.
Really?
Yes. I remember that's my earliest memory.
Where was that then? That was in northern Afghanistan?
That was in northern Afghanistan, yes.
What was it called? Where was you brought up?
It's Kunduz to Talakan or Tachar province.
Okay.
In between 78 kilometres, between two cities.
Ah, okay. And what was childhood like growing up? Did you feel unsafe? What was it like?
Well, it was always traumatic and it was unsafe. Pretty much because of the so many government changes and this Mujahideens and the Najib time as well.
What is that?
President Najib.
Okay.
Yeah, it's after Mujahideen win the war and then the civil war basically start up. So it wasn't very pleasant.
And was the schooling?
Well, I did 2 years, first 2 years in Tachar province at school. And then I came back to Kunduz, start again that 2 years.
Yeah. And what was the education standard like? Was the Taliban in when you was at school?
That time it wasn't the Taliban. I'm talking about the phase one in my life.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was long before Taliban. Yeah, it was a Mujahideen time. As in like when Najib government collapse.
Yeah.
After that, then I start studying in Sheikh Khan High School.
Okay, that's the high school now.
No, this Sheikh Khan High School. That was grade one, basically.
Oh, right, okay.
Grade one
or two.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But our books was quite different.
Really?
Yeah.
And when we talk about like kind of a traumatic childhood, what would be included in that? Why would your childhood be traumatic?
Well, first thing, the book we were studying, it wasn't one apple plus one banana,
right,
equal to three pomegranate. It was one grenade plus one knife equal to two gun, something like that. So, and again, it was I think it was the standard quite poor, and we were, you know, as well. Most of the families, they didn't have that standard to put their child into a good education. So we were just going and coming back. But I was always the brightest. I never came first, but I always come second and third.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How many was there in your family? How many brothers and sisters?
I've got seven brothers, including me, eight, one sister.
All right.
I'm the oldest, yes.
Oh, really?
Yes, I am.
And what was kind of like the family unit like growing up?
Well, in terms of responsibilities, I start taking when I was like 13 or 14, responsibilities for my father. And I was always helping him as driving the bus with 60 people on top.
Really?
Yeah, when I was 14, yeah.
And just to kind of get, I guess it's, I'm just trying to clear my mind with it. So were you in a village or was you in like a town where you was brought up?
We were in city.
In a city?
Yeah. Okay. Village, at that time, village, I barely have, you know, the opportunity to go to the schools.
Yeah. And then you'd go to school and then you'd started work with your dad when you was 13, but was you still going to education as well?
Yes, I remember the education never stops, because of my mom is really into education. So everywhere, anything I learn is because of him. My dad really not really the type of, you know, he like us, he love us, but he never really pay attention of the education. I believe he was so busy. He's the eldest son of his father, which he has a lot of many brothers and sisters, so he was kind of responsible to everyone. So, yeah, he was seeing us like his brothers, so, yeah.
And the city you was in, going to school and going about normal business when you were 13, was it a safe place to be? Did you feel safe growing up?
Well, as a kid, you're always happy and you never care. But in terms of experience, if you put it in comparison, it was very traumatic. Yes, I remember many times. I've seen people got shot in front of me. I've seen, in Kunduz, there's a football stadium, basically. So when they hang people, they call people to come and have a look. It was even broadcast on TV, so at a time.
Public hangings?
Public hangings, yes.
And this was still the Mujahideen time, or was this going on?
Well, it was the Mujahideen time, but Mujahideen time was the only people who get hanged was the people who commit the worst crime. Yeah, I remember one, that was in Talakan. I remember one guy was basically raping women and killing them always. I remember he was quite known to the city. People really talk about him. He didn't accept anyone until one big commander asked him, "You're my friend, tell me the truth. Have you done it?" Then he said, "Yes, done it." And then they straight away hang him. So the Mujahideen time was the only one who get, you know, punishment or death. Is the worst you could imagine. They commit crime, the worst crime, basically. Yeah, but the Taliban time was a normal, you know. Because I grew up under the regime of Taliban. Even when I was going to school, English school, I had to wear turbans and do some Islamic study because to justify my English course.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah.
But English wasn't totally banned?
Well, there's only two guys eventually. I mean, in the in Kunduz, there was only two guys during the Taliban. One was migrated from Kabul, which was a Tajik ethnicity, and the other one was a Pashtun. So there was only two teachers, and we had to rely on him, on them two persons.
Yeah.
So what happened, they banned him. They banned him not to teach English. Then he really tried his best, because that's the only way he was making money to feed his family, as he was himself refugee.
Right, okay.
From Kabul. So, he didn't introduce a day Islamic, one day every Wednesday, compulsory turban, and compulsory study, Islamic study, which was beneficial for, it wasn't the extreme type, it was just a basics Islamic.
Yeah, okay.
Because then we justified the other 5 days of studying English.
All right, okay. It's so much more relaxed than I thought you was going to say. I thought it would be, you know, all banned and it'd be really quite hardcore.
The later on, when we did sixth semester, all the top guys, which was me included, and the other guy, Ahmad Azizi, who's now in America, and the other guy, I believe, I forgot his name, but we call him Mali, and he's in America too. And Ahmad Fahim, he's in America as well. I believe I know some others. They're mostly in America now. They've got top jobs as well. We start to make our own English course. That was when I think it was 1998 or 1999, I believe there was a computer firstly introduced. Oh, yeah. So we remember we gathered the money and enjoy and bought a computer. I was practicing MS-DOS.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then the sign for the English course was Payama Haq. It was, we chose an other name, then they come and torn our sign and say they put different names. So Payam Haq means a message for right message.
Right.
Basically is a message of God.
Yeah.
They sent, they changed our sign to that name.
Oh, right.
Later
okay,
on, then we ran it 1.5 years and then it collapsed itself because of the restrictions and, yeah, because it was all, we ourselves tried to do something, you know,
yeah,
to gather more people. And then...
And what, why was speaking English and understanding English so important?
The town Kunduz is not very big, and they, there's a, how to say, if something become viral in YouTube or in Facebook or Instagram nowadays, as people talk about it, in Kunduz, anything small change comes, everybody copy, and they're really into growing themselves. They always want to do something, especially the youngster. So, and to be honest, there's not much was happening in the school. So the only way to justify, because most family background is an educated background. You know, my mom went to school in Kabul, so they always want their kids to do something, to study at least something. Sometimes because people who are from the other tribe, they are really into Islamic studies. There's a lot of madrasa and things like that happening there. I mean, the people study. But therefore, it's kind of place that whoever get young, they want to do something.
Mm.
They are not like sit down and do nothing.
Like everywhere
in
the world,
yeah.
Really.
Yeah, the, as in now, people are growing beard. It's common now.
Yeah,
sending their daughters to you know, this Islamic madrasa, and eventually they get crazy. Yeah, so this is the new viral thing going on there at the moment.
It's extreme.
Very extreme, I believe so, yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
97, you got engaged.
Well, in that time, sir.
Yeah, what was the, culturally, what was...
Well, because I was the eldest and, you know, the eldest son, wife, supposed to help with the mum.
Yeah.
It happens, so it's a fatherhood thing that they want to be proud and get their sons, you know. It's very old styles.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's good. I believe it's better than, you know, tasting everything than,
yeah,
you know.
It's, I mean, it's different to it.
It's tasty.
Yeah.
You really like it. I mean, if you actually copy the way I did, that means... You know somebody, you give it a time, 10, 12 years, and then you grow up. You still have an option to disengage.
Yeah.
But then if you like, then you go on. So once you're into from childhood in one thing, and then you grow that chemistry.
Yeah, because you were both the same age when you met.
Yeah, yeah,
and,
yeah.
And then obviously later on, which we'll get to,
well,
got married.
The meeting is, somehow like you meet... And then you don't see them for 5 years because it's not like you just go together.
Mm.
Yeah, so they give you just a hope. You're there and you're confirmed and you will have someone. So
We'll see you when you're 17 or 18.
18, like yeah. But later on in our, I mean, mostly in our families, when they get wiser and better as a man, and then they move on to... proper life.
Mm. When you were getting better, you started helping your dad run the mill. What was it like at that time then? You was about 13 or 14 when you started working with your dad.
Well, it was an on and off because in Afghanistan it's an open market, and I did my father did driving, I did mill, and I did a shopkeeping. So we had small businesses everywhere. So it was good. I mean, in terms of financially, we were okay.
Mm.
But in terms of how, you know, how hard we struggle, that's something, you know, not many people experience that. Yeah, there was a time the income was good. You know, when you do business right, it's better.
Yeah. Was your dad entrepreneurial? Was he a businessman, your dad? Or is he?
As a man, we're hunter, so we always look for food and money. Nowadays, it's money, but it's basically for food. So Afghanistan life is survival.
Yeah.
It's not living. So you're always thinking of surviving, of doing this, doing that, but you're busy there, yeah.
And then is it does it fall on the eldest son to kind of carry that on? So as soon as you're 13, are you trying to do the hunting for the money?
I believe it was my uncle, then with my father, and with the other guy, they are three partners.
Mm.
So the partner gave up, my uncle gave up, and it was me and my father. My father gave up, then eventually I gave up.
Yeah.
My second brother did it, and then eventually we dismantled.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what kind of thing was you doing?
It was basically, first thing, you buy wheat and then make it flour and then sell it again. They make profit out of it. Or people bring the wheat themselves. You just process it and give it back.
Mm.
And then you take some wheat and then you sell it. But that time it was, people were extremely poor. So it was, the time it was, I helped people a lot.
Mm. When did you first start seeing British and American troops?
I believe it was the 2 days I worked with American, it was on...
That was the first time you'd seen...
Yeah, late 2001. No, that thing is early 2003, sorry. Yeah.
Oh, something. So a couple of years after the first commit.
Yeah, when they come almost 2002.
Yeah, okay.
But when Kunduz, they come a bit later.
Yeah.
Because it takes them time to come.
Yeah. And what was the general feeling like? Was it a welcoming feeling? Was it...
I believe.
Can you remember?
When the situation is very worse, any small changes is a welcoming, and it's. We hope. The idea wasn't why American coming. The idea was how we move on.
Mm.
It wasn't about why America come or how they come, but obviously the leaders decide whether they come or not. But the Kunduz was zoned and. It was a bit difficult for them to come as early as possible.
Mm.
Because all the Taliban gathered in Kunduz at that time.
Oh, really?
When they start, bombing them.
So where you live got bombed?
Well, no. When they start, when they were leaving, they got bombed on the way. On the highway,
right, okay.
Yeah. But Kunduz, they were, they were ready to do anything, but the number was like, they were overcrowded.
How many people were there then? How many Taliban was...
I believe that was... I think it was more than 15,000. In that small city, yes.
15,000, what, Taliban fighters?
Yes. After 9/11, they all gathered... they left all the front lines, came to Kunduz.
And you were there?
And I was there, yeah. I remember I asked one of them, give me a gun...
Yeah.
Give me your motorbike.
Yeah.
He tried to do an airplan.
What were the Taliban like? Were they mainly Afghan?
Oh, no.
Pakistan? Where?
I believe I've seen...
For the back then, when they were all gathered, yeah, in the 15th?
Yeah, I've seen many Uzbekistani and Pakistani, mostly.
Yeah.
The dark skin was very dark.
Yeah.
And then I at that time, I didn't know other, but I've seen Uzbekistani and Pakistani.
Did you fear them?
Yes. One time they almost sent me to front line.
Go on.
Yeah, I had a... When I was in that mill, there was a guy who wanted to beat me up and try to overcome, you know, try to, how to say, bully me.
Yeah.
So what happened? I had a fight, and we fight gone up. I beat him, so then I put his head in the flower. So then the commander asked me, come. Basically, they took me there. And that time, punishment, all this, you know, civilian punishment was, if anything you do, you will be sent to front line, regardless of what have you done. That was your punishment.
Oh, and when they say the front line, what was that? Where was the front line?
Front line was that time between Talakan and Kunduz.
And that was fighting the Americans?
No, fighting the government now, this government.
Right.
At that time, yeah.
Okay, punishment from the Taliban?
Was to send you to front line. It's not like you go and help them. They ask you to go fight, you can't return. If you return, they will shoot you themselves. So you come back is 0% chance. Yeah.
A suicide mission.
Basically, yeah, this is something like they give you this idea, if you run back, we'll kill you. So you have to fight, make your way, go ahead.
Hmm. Did you, move us on a little bit now, fast forward us a little bit, you started working for the Chinese government in...
Not the government.
Sorry, the Chinese company, sorry, beg your pardon. Chinese companies, as an interpreter, is that right?
Well, yes, as a translator or interpreter, yeah.
And then what did that entail?
Well, I worked there because I got a job, basically, late 2003. They offered me money. I was jobless, so I believe it was about... and then I started working just a normal translator or interpreter.
And in doing what, though? Was it just business, or was the business with the US? Was the business with the Brits?
No,
the
business was the road constructions.
Yeah, okay.
We built roads, basically. Yeah, it wasn't very political. The Chinese were subcontractor from the American company.
Yeah.
It's a Louis Berger group, something like that.
Funded
by World Bank. Yeah.
Right, okay. Was that at that point, because I know road building got horrendously dangerous, especially later on. At that time, was it going in fine? Was the Taliban...
It was going fine until they came and... On, I think it was 10 June 2004, they killed 13 Chinese.
Really?
I was there as well. They come at night, one night and shoot them. Those guys, yeah.
Explain the situation.
The basically, the new laborers they bring from China and put them in a tent, sleep for a night. That second night, they got shot by some people, which they are released now, working around. At that time, Kunduz was safe.
Mm.
It was post-American time. After American come in, Kunduz was the safest place.
So who killed the Chinese?
I think these four guys, there, you know, they've been to court.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah,
so not the Taliban.
But that time, you cannot differentiate who he is or who he worked for, you know, why he have done it.
Yeah.
So anyone could be anyone.
Yeah, okay.
Because that time Taliban was weak. But even if they were Taliban, they could have, you know, do it under different names.
Yeah, it was just chaotic and almost make-believe.
So basically that time I had protection, police protection, until the project finished. And that's the time I came to UK.
Yeah.
First time.
Oh, did you...
I came,
UK?
Yeah. And then I got basically caught here, and they say, you have to give asylum. I give them, they put them on fast track. Within 12 days, they put me in detention. I had to apply and go back to Afghanistan.
Really?
Yes.
And then, what year was that?
That was, I think I went back 10 October 2007.
And then a year later, you started working for the British?
I think it was 5 months later I started working with American and then with British.
Okay. So can we move us on to working with the British then?
Yeah.
What was your kind of initial job when you worked?
Well, my initial job was I was doing in a OP as a translator, and obviously the ICOM charter, I believe the forces know that was the main job. That was the, you know, one of the things on your job descriptions you have to do.
Yeah.
And to listen to ICOM charters.
So you, and just if we go before that, what was the process, the kind of, did you have a job interview? Did you have to pass tests?
Well, yes. I think I was picked out of 18.
Hmm.
Yeah, you have to go through the test. Test was, compared to American forces, it was harder.
Yeah.
Because most of the American interpreters cannot pass this test because it was...
To be with the British?
Yes. Because they, one, the money was good. So two, you need to have a good Pashto understanding. Three, you need to have a good verbal English, you know, good English. Because I was in the UK and I worked with American forces. And I've done the British English in Kunduz, not the American system. So I did it 9 semesters.
Yeah.
So that's why it helped me a lot, which my English is not very good at this time.
Oh, it's better than mine.
No.
And then, so you, how does it then work? Do you get kind of assigned to a battalion or to a troop, or how does the actual intricacies, for those that have never had interpreters, how do you actually work with the British on
basically
the ground?
You go on a main camp and 10 or 6 or any numbers. So sometimes if you're like far away, you don't have the, you know, opportunity to come back to the main camp. Then you're staying there. Basically most of the front lines and the or the OPs or the but then anyone going patrol or doing anything from the main camp, then they choose one. They just call one, and obviously the one who speak good English,
yeah,
and very friendly, they are being called. The grumpy ones is always ignored.
Yeah. You did you was in Musakala.
Yes, that I was in
first,
Musakala.
And you did that, you was there for 7 months.
First 7 months, 5 days, yeah.
Yeah. You're my...
Precisely.
Yeah, precisely, yeah. And who was you with in Musakala?
I think I was first time I came, I was a week with Irish Guard, I believe. I'm not sure, but it was 5 Scot, and it was 2 RGR, the Gurkha regiment.
And you was with Gurkhas for the longest?
The whole time. When they come in, I went back with them.
And you was
finished the tour.
And just to confirm this, so you was out with patrol, so you'd get fired on. You'd take.
My job was that first 7 months was quite not that safer, but it was very dangerous if it was come to the, you know, in terms of calculation how safe it was. But we were just getting lucky because the forbidden bra was created, and then the pressure on that OP was less.
Ah, right, okay.
Yeah.
Did you build relationships with the British, the individuals and the Gurkhas? You know, the British Army. Did you feel like you was part of the team?
I was definitely. If you're not part of the team, you're not there for an hour, and you have to be 100% in the job, and because you're the eyes and ears, and it's not like you're someone from different place or different things.
Yeah.
You have to think the same. Sometimes more than the soldiers, because soldiers sometimes, most of them, they just come up from the training, they don't know anything. So you're the one there, you know, just answering their, you know, awkward questions most of the time.
Yeah.
So that's how they understand. Yeah.
And do you... Do you, just if, let's say there's a a troop of 30 people or 10 or 8, whatever it is, do you start, you know, do you start having banter with them? Do you start having jokes with them? Do you feel like you're, what I'm trying to get is, do you feel like you...
Connected,
yeah.
Yes, obviously, yeah. When
and trusted, and you rely on them, and they're relying on you.
In the army, one, it's an automatic feeling that you have to trust somebody. Two, you have to create bonds. And that's how, what makes you being in the army.
Hmm.
And when you create bonds and you're there, and they're like a part of your life, which you will not forget it. And so obviously you always have, you know, story to listen and you talk. And most of the time is, you know, going like this.
Hmm.
And basically when a hard time comes, people help you or people are there. And that's the time you create the strongest bond.
Mm, in adversity, when it's hostile.
Yes, it is.
And you went through, you know, a vast period of that. I mean, the British will come for 6-7 months and then leave.
And then leave, but, and the new guys come in.
Yeah.
And then you have to be with them as well. Yeah, and but they, for us, we have been with so many regiments, so the very common question and the awkward one as was that who was better? And I was coming with laugh always and doing the saying nothing.
Yeah.
Because they always want to say what the interpreter thinks.
Yeah.
Who was better?
Yeah.
Us or them?
And did you, within that though, you must have built some kind of like almost special relationships with individuals. Because you do create bonds, especially if there's a lot of people going through.
A lot of people, one thing is in common, the soldier comes 6 months and go. What we were focusing, especially people who do things right, I was not there for networking. I was there to help and be part of it, and then at the same time, carry on my life and to provide myself. And my focus was, there are people, they do a lot of networking when they were there, but my focus was to just do your job, never ignore any jobs, because you can't, as in the army, translator can ignore a job. I say, I don't want to go, but a soldier, they don't.
Mm.
Mostly when I've seen many interpreters, when they ignore the jobs, they're being, you know, not the best in the among themselves.
Mm.
So therefore I always focus on jobs and whatever I was being told, and I just carry on doing and so never ignore a command.
So would you get stuck in with the guys if they were doing manual work, you know, to maintain an area, or I mean, you wouldn't carry a weapon?
Yeah, no, I wasn't carrying up. Obviously, when it comes to filling bags, you know, someone you're spending 24 hours with them and they're filling and you're standing there, you can't do that, can you? So, therefore, you always help, but it's not very effective with it, you know, filling the bags. But, yeah, there was a time carrying ammunitions or helping the guy when they fall down.
Yeah.
With the, I forgot the name. It's the orange color and the blue color.
Okay.
As the one would cut the signals.
Okay.
Yeah, I forgot the name.
Yeah,
it's been a long time. Yeah, so mostly it's so heavy. And the soldier, the young soldier, they fall down with that 50 degree heat.
Mm.
So you're always there, help. Yeah. Especially when they jump a ditch or somewhere. Therefore, there was a time, I carry ammunition most of the time.
Yeah.
And you're always busy as well. You have ICOM ammunition and your own food for 3-4 days. So.
But you're out when the guys go out for patrol, you're out with
sometimes
them.
You're the first, yes.
Yeah.
You're the second. The third is a must. You've never been at the back.
Yeah.
Even if you're at the back, you're slow, they'll escort you to the front. You're with the commanders, because they don't want to lose you there.
Yeah.
It happens a lot. Some of this interpreters have been forgotten because everybody's exhausted there, and sometimes they're just going to sleep.
Was you fit?
Yes, I was. I can see the. I show you a picture. Yeah, I was fit. Yeah.
Yeah. What was your? Because you. Who else was you with then? Because I mean, the thing is, we're trying to condense. 2008 to 2014. Okay. Of you being an interpreter, and with the British, there was a lot going on. You know, there was tour after tour. For you, it was just life. You know, you're living in conflict. You know, since you was a child, but then you know the British coming in, you're creating bonds. What was your opinion of the British military?
My opinion, in a broader picture, I cannot comment. But
no,
the military, but they were doing just the job being told, and then I think at that time we were doing the best we could.
Yeah.
Means there's nothing wrong to stop a bad guy doing something wrong. I mean, you can see the result on the street, even in London.
Mm.
The amount of drugs cultivated there is a direct effect.
Yeah.
So if you don't stop them there, the poor guy will not suffer here. So is this the scenario, you know? You're just preventing what happened in the future.
Mm.
So that's the role, basically, and that's what they're supposed to do.
You got injured in March 2010.
I believe so.
How can you explain how you got injured?
Well, I was I knew it, the attack is happening. I was listening. Then the mortar was start coming. I think there were a short number of people with a car came in with a 62mm mortar. They came in and started throwing at us.
Yeah.
So I tried to hide, but then the shrapnels got me. I had a piece of shrapnel on my eyes and under my armpits and my lower body. And it was Cat B injury.
Mm.
And the time I got injured, I was supposed to get the American chopper to come pick me.
Yeah.
But within half an hour of that time, somebody else got a double amputee in Sangin. So they went there to pick him. That was priority number one.
Yeah.
And then they came back later for me. So it took them to come until I arrived back in 3 hours, 45 minutes, almost 4 hours. So.
Did you have morphine?
I tried not to have it, but they just beforehand they just shot it out of my legs. Yes, they want to do it again. I said, don't do it.
Really?
Yeah, because you are warm. You don't know a lot. Or probably it was the. But you feel it's not something, you don't feel it.
Yeah. So it was your eye under your armpit,
and my armpit and buttocks. Yes. And another piece on top of ribs. But my under armpit was quite a big hole.
Was
there.
It?
Yeah. So we didn't even stitch it, because if we stitch it, limit my movement of my hand. So it was a hole until a month. So I was just putting gas.
Yeah, gauze.
And gauze, yeah. And
rechange it. Did you, the care you received after your injury, was it good? Did you feel like there was any difference between a British or an American soldier and yourself? Did you get the care?
The care is a basic what other soldier get. You get the same thing, but then because they didn't have the facility to do the eyes surgery, they sent me to Bagram Airfield.
Mm.
Yeah, but when I went to Bagram. Then they wanted to send me to Germany for the eye surgery, because it was at the back of the eye. And then I was about to go to Germany, and somebody called from British Army and say, Afghans shouldn't go anywhere.
Oh, really?
Them. Yeah, yeah. So, yeah. That American colonel was crying for me. She was a woman. So, but then eventually I got very lucky. The doctor did... very hard for me on the eyes. I had some many lasers on my eyes.
Yeah. Is it back to normal now? Can you see?
it's he said that you're 1 out of 100 lucky. Normally you don't get 20/20 vision if you have retina detachment. For some reason it's okay, but it is affecting when I do some, you know, put a little bit pressure,
yeah,
like on the phone or on screens. It gives me a bit of pain instead of this on that one, on the right side.
Oh, the good side?
Yeah, the good side, because the pressure came here for some reason, yeah.
After the injury, how long did it take? A month to get
recovered? In total, I was 12 days in Bagram and about 3 days in Bashan. And then I was 18 days afterward, I was at home. And then I report back. In total, about a month, yeah.
About a month, so back to work.
Back to work, yeah.
And you'd got married. You got married in 2009.
2009, yeah.
So, and then your first child.
That time, my wife was pregnant with the first child.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Were you together? She wasn't in Musakala, no?
No, she was in Kunduz, no.
How far is that away for you to get back?
That's more than 1,400 kilometres.
Right.
I was basically in tour. I mean, Musakala, people think we are strangers too.
yeah,
it's very far.
And then did you see the birth of your first child?
Well, it's common here you attend with a birth, but back home it's mostly family things. So you're not very attached and you're not going there.
Yeah.
You just get the news,
right? Okay.
And prepare money for the doctor or something. But it's mostly family, because I was too busy in the army, so
yeah.
My role was just to be husband. All the responsibility was the father. It's a big family, so
yeah.
And the family do everything.
And your first child, boy or girl?
A girl.
Girl first.
Yeah, it's girl first. Yeah.
Me too.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. You went back after your injury.
Yeah.
So did you manage to see your daughter?
Not really. No, I had to call them to come to Kabul for the first time.
Okay. And when was the how old was she when you first held her?
I think I was. She was about a month or so.
Okay.
Yeah, because it wasn't very safe at that time. We were very cautious, so. I tried to avoid, you know, to travel to Kunduz, obviously because of the jobs. And I rented here and there in Kabul. When she was coming to Kabul, because her family was in Kabul.
Right, okay.
So she was on and off Kabul, Kunduz, Kabul, Kunduz.
Yeah. Second child was born the next year. Oh, well. Officially,
yeah, that
2012,
was
2012.
2012, yeah.
She was born on Christmas Day.
Yeah,
2011. Boy or Christmas, girl?
A boy, yeah.
So he was born Christmas Day 2011.
Yeah.
Again, was you around at that point? Was you away with?
I was at work at the same time as well.
Whereabouts? Can you remember where you was?
I believe it was the end of. I think it was with the FRV. Unit. I was with the FRV, which is logistic. I was with them, yeah.
Okay.
And he was born in Kunduz. I was in Kabul. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's one is normal. Two, I was avoiding most of the time going to back to Kunduz.
And then, I mean, I'm just going to wrap this part up. But then you had a third child.
Yeah.
2013.
Yeah.
Boy or girl?
A boy.
So you got a girl, two boys.
Yeah.
All within 3 years?
You can say it, yes, 3 years, yeah.
Mm. At this point, had you felt like you had been there? Is the father role the same in Afghanistan as it is in the UK?
In terms of... I believe there is more.
Yeah.
Here, father role is mostly the government. But there is all you. Alone, I think the responsibility is more there than the family. I mean, here if you're not able, then there's someone to help. But there it's you and your family. So
you're responsible.
You're responsible. No one else. No, you don't have any other insurance outside that compound or where you're living.
And that's why it was so important for you to keep working.
Work is a part of, yes. That's the things that you have to, you know, do it. People do it for many, you know, things for their kids.
Did you feel the kids were safe with your family, with your wife, with you away?
What situation at what time?
When they were all young, so maybe when the third was born, when he was born.
By that time, I called him to be with me in Kabul.
Right.
Yeah. At least a house in there, and an apartment. So.
Yeah.
I was there with me, but any time I get too busy or do something, they go to Kunduz and come back. So it's back and forth, living in two different places. Because my main house is in Kunduz, my house, which is from my father. Yeah.
And well, I suppose what I'm getting at is, had Afghanistan changed to the point where you felt like the children could travel easily and safely? Did you feel like from the childhood you'd had to, you know, 2014, was 2014 a safer place for your children to be?
Compared to 2006, 7 or 2004, it's worse in comparison. It's the worst time the children could be in this situation. Nowadays, they easily can be manipulated to other things, and which is that mostly the lack of education and political ideas. So this trend in Kunduz, it's somehow it affects everyone's, you know. You can't, if you all your classmates do something, you can't avoid one guy not to do the same thing. So you kind of get habit,
peer
or
pressure,
you copy
well.
Them, feel pressure, yeah.
But yours at that time was very small.
My ones at that time small, but the safety, it's only because me, where I work, my past.
Yeah.
People in Afghanistan judge you, what you pass and where you from, or where you come from. It's not, they don't judge you, they judge your father and your work and your ethnicity. Therefore, it was the time that I thought it's not very safe. Yeah, I mean, it's not very safe. That's a fact. Everybody knows that.
You stopped working for the British in 2014, the end of 2014. And then in 2015, you made the journey by yourself from Afghanistan to the UK.
Yeah, after I'm being terminated unreasonably. And then I had no choice but to move out. We were talking about redundancy. I was on the list of redundancy, but then to move here, and because of the pressure from the government of cutting all the numbers, they find any small reason just to terminate, not to get the redundancy.
Was the reasoning why you decided to come to the UK, was that to do with opportunity, for safety for your children, a mixture of all these things?
I believe one thing, what have you done, and I believe we deserve as interpreters, most of us did risk on their life and deserve to be safer after everything happened. And the second thing is obviously for the children. Our time is gone already. Yeah, and you're over 30 and you've not done nothing apart from your jobs, a bit of money. But those are not very important now. But all it is important for the next generation.
How long did it take you to get to the UK?
Well, it takes about 3 to 4 months, but I was in Greece, so I asked the family to come to get after I came to Greece. So they got deported from Iran once from the border of Turkey, so therefore I waited in Greece for a bit of time. Yeah, in total it takes a bit of time, three and a half months for.
Well, and now look, we're in 2019 now. You haven't seen your children since
6 June 2015.
And your wife died 2016.
Yeah, April.
When you got to the UK, and especially after your wife died, and you've got your three children who were very small still, and especially then, you know, 3 years ago, why is it so hard for you to get the kids back, to get them safe in this country, especially when you've been, you know, you've worked with the British, and you mentioned the safety aspect now of going back to Afghanistan, and it's just, it would be a matter, when we spoke before, it would be a matter of time, or if something happened to you and when something happened to you and not if something happened to you. Something bad would happen to you if you went back to Afghanistan.
Definitely, yeah. More likely.
Why is it such a long, drawn-out process to get your children to you?
I believe it's mainly the Home Office and not recognizing the job we have done, and I believe they just process us as a someone who just jump in from the boat, and then nobody pay attention basically, and it's all this paperwork. Every letter you send, you get the response in 2 months, so it takes them very long time. But the one thing I did was wait, and I always believe that there's always a brightness after the darkness. So,
yeah.
It is the government purely not think through properly. They just thought that they have done the ex gratia scheme, and they were finished. But there's a lot more people back at Kabul or in Afghanistan still suffering, which they did some sacrifice. I know a guy who did 15 years for the British Army, recently got attacked, and with his kid is still, you know, having trouble. But it's purely the government doing very slow, and I think it's morally not right what they're doing. Because in the future, they will be judged what they have done eventually.
You mentioned suffering a second ago. Do you suffer now?
I still suffer. I went there and they got my name wrong. I've done the fingerprint 5 times and they still got it wrong.
Do you suffer emotionally? Do you suffer? We spoke before. I've got 3 children, and I would feel, even thinking about it, in pain, physically sick. I couldn't imagine being apart from them. And as a dad, do you feel?
We feel very hard and very emotional, as well as very hard, because we grow up very hard. I mean, being strong, never lose a grip. So that makes you stand and fight back again until you overcome what you wanted.
What would you say your mental health was now? Did you have good mental health or poor mental health?
Well, I cannot give a score or a scale, a number for it, but anyone in that situation could have a poor mental health. But the mental health is something that it can get better easily, as long as things are getting right, in the right direction, and getting help.
Have you worked? Do you work now? Do you work for anybody now?
Not really, no.
So what do you live on? How do you live?
I get some money, a little bit, £35 something a week, and then I get help from brothers, my savings. Well, mainly families, you know. I don't have savings, but family.
So you get a very small amount from the government.
I think that's every asylum seeker. Yeah, every asylum seeker gets
asylum. Yeah,
asylum seeker. Yes.
Do you live in your own flat? How do you?
Currently, a friend helping, but then he gave up. Then I'm sofa surfing. Friend, yes.
You're sofa surfing.
Well, a friend help, yeah, kind of. Another friend, which is with a small money, that's considered sofa surfing.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Do you feel betrayed? Do you feel like it's... I don't want to put words into your mouth, so let's rephrase it, because...
I think...
Do you feel let down?
I'm being lost.
Do you?
In the system. Yeah, I think they need to pay more attention. Betrayal is a different thing. It hit people hard, but if you're my wisdom say I'm being lost, and the system should work out, you know, in different way, because it's eventually and morally wrong for the forces. In the future, I mean, nobody will help them in terms of, you know, the people see what happened. In comparison, like what happened to Iraq and what the interpreter gets here, how they came in, how the Afghans were treated. So it's not now only.
As we speak now, you won a court case a few months ago to give you refugee status.
Yeah.
Which will then mean there's an hour time frame. So thankfully, your children will be able to join you once all that gets crossed. But we're still looking at
That's not certain how they will phrase it. They have not received the card yet, but they just won the court. So it's after when they issue the card, they will tell me the terms how my kids will be here. So I've not seen what restriction they will put in terms of my kids. Either they say you work certain amount of money, you bring them in, or you're a refugee, so they can come automatically. Again, you have to apply for DNA and some other paperwork, and then the application, entry clearance, all these things.
The six, seven, and eight, how old are they now?
I think it's 6, 7, 8, yeah. And they have to go through all these things, which is...
Do they miss you? What?
I'm in contact, yes. Some of them ask me, when are you coming? I say, I'm not coming, you're coming. So, I actually had a plan to move them out, but then eventually I won the case.
Sounds like a ridiculous question, but are you looking forward to seeing them again?
Definitely, yes. Yeah, I can't wait for that time.
Yeah,
can't wait. Yeah, I'm thinking. I just thinking how to see them. This is the main point, because I saw them little. Now it's them big. Also, I see them in behind the phone, but actual, I didn't feel them. You know. But I lost those 3 years, and that's something I sacrificed only purely for them. So
it's like you're like the anchor, trying to hold it here to give them the opportunity.
Yes, as I said, we did our hard. I could have lived very happily without involving or doing anything, just a normal sell potato, for example. And but at the same time, you don't accept yourself, don't allow bad things happen. And then you also think of future, which is the kids, and you have to give them something, at least an opportunity.
Do you live for the future?
That's what we are. Otherwise, we will not exist one day.
No, I mean, sorry.
We say we live for future. We hope we live for hopes. That we fulfill.
I think our lives are different, and I'm trying to put myself in your situation. And I live for me. I live very much day to day and have plans for the future? Because there's so much uncertainty, what I mean is, are you wishing your life away to get to the future so the kids are with you?
That's the wish, and hope is quite different. You're hoping that you live long, and wishes that are a little bit stronger, that I wish my kids were here, but I'm wishing that they should to be with me. But in terms of future, we live for futures, otherwise what will not exist.
What does the future hold? What's your...
My future is to just live happy and do good things, improve the, you know, any human life. I mean, anything you can contribute.
And then practically, you know, because the kids, I are very, you know, once the kids are here with you, and you've got your refugee status and you've got the card, is it about work to support the family? Would you then look for work?
Definitely, yeah. I can't stop here, and it's not the end of the world. I mean, you suffer for a time and then you wake up and you start again. I mean, definitely, I have to do something. I mean, I'm looking forward to do something better. At least I present the kids, a good kids for the future, and then myself. Yes, definitely. It's not something I stop here. Not the end of the world. I'll have to do something. It's not easy here as well. Life is here also not easy.
Yeah. If you could give any advice to someone else in your situation, maybe a few years behind you, what have you learned what have you learned from the last 2-3 years?
One thing I've learned, patience. And whatever you want, you have to ask for it and do it in the right way. You will get it. And then stay strong and be positive. Always think of the positive way. If I have the mindset of negativity, then even when I enter here, it was a negative point for me by just entering in a very worse situation. So always keep the positive mindset and you will achieve.